This generation of Arabs has a different set, a globalized set of expectations. That means it's not just about making sure they have a job. They expect to be able to participate. They expect to be able to set their own path in life and not just have it directed for them by their monarch or their father or their uncle or anybody else. And at essence, what they expect is the thing that liberal societies are best structured to provide, which is the opportunity for every individual to find their own path to human flourishing. Okay, if I can put it in philosophical terms. So it's not, governments can't get away with just, you know, offering enough jobs or enough healthcare or enough free education. Check the box and they are legitimate. They have to meet that set of expectations. Yeah. They have to give people opportunity to find for themselves a pathway. And that means they have to be more open. They have to be more responsive.
I'm Quinta Jurecic, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, November 26th, 2016. This week on the podcast, we're bringing you some post-Thanksgiving food for thought on the state of the Arab world. Last Monday, Madeleine Albright, Tamara Kaufman-Wittes, Stephen Hadley, and Amar Hawzawi sat down at the Brookings Institution to discuss Tamara's new report on real security, governance, and stability in the Arab world, which was commissioned by the Atlantic Council's Middle East Strategy Task Force, chaired by Albright and Hadley. What led to the breakdown of governance across Arab countries? What can be done to establish more stable governance and increase security? And what role does the United States have in all of this? It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 198, Real Security, Governance and Stability in the Arab World.
Look, it may seem as though today's topic is an odd choice for focus. Maybe it's not a propitious time to talk about governance in the Middle East. After all, we're dealing with a region in violent turmoil, beset by vicious civil war. The U.S. and its allies are now invested in a new military conflict in Iraq and also in Syria, fighting ISIS. And indeed, I just came back from an international security forum up in Halifax, where the only discussion of the Middle East there was framed around terrorism, ISIS, civil war, and refugees. And these are the urgent problems that are seen by many governments around the world as a threat to international security, deservedly so, and that are driving attention to the region. But it's precisely because of those urgent challenges that I think it's valuable to focus in this report on governance in the region. Because to my mind, ISIS and the civil wars are symptoms of something bigger. They are symptoms of a broader breakdown in the region. They're not the disease. And what we've seen beginning in late 2010 was the breakdown both of individual states and of a state system in the Middle East that had lasted since the Eisenhower administration. A state system that had advantaged American interests and those of our regional partners, a system that the United States sought to defend. And it's that breakdown of the Middle East order that has led to the civil wars in Libya and Yemen and Syria and the rise of ISIS. And so understanding why and how this regional order broke down, I think, is necessary to understand how we effectively deal not just with the symptoms of that breakdown, but with the challenge of restoring lasting stability to this region. And that is the premise and the driving question of the report that we're releasing today. So let me focus on just three things about that breakdown that I think it's important for us to understand and what they suggest about the path ahead. So the first thing to understand is the regional order broke down because of things that happened inside states, inside societies, because of pressures that built up over many years. And the first part of that story is the story I told in the book that I published in 2008, Freedom's Unsteady March. That's the story of how the bureaucratic authoritarian model in the Arab world began to weaken, how the clientelism, the ideology, the coercive mechanisms that these states relied on to survive were becoming less and less effective in a globalized world. They rested on a certain kind of social contract. A clientelistic contract or a corporatist contract or a patronage-based contract. And over time, these systems became more and more inefficient on their own terms. And then they were challenged both from within and without, from a demographic bulge of young people on the cusp of adulthood, from the effects of a globalized economy, and from a radically new information environment prompted first by satellite television and then by the World Wide Web 1.0 and 2.0. And so the effect on citizens in these countries was that the expectations created under the old social contract could not be fulfilled in these changed conditions. And just to give you a couple of indicators of this, the Egyptian government, dating back to Nasser, had promised that university graduates would be able to get a civil service job. By the early 2000s, the wait time for those university graduates to get that civil service job was on average 8 years. So that's 8 years of pushing a food cart or driving a taxi or twiddling your thumbs, waiting for your life to begin. And in the meantime, you can't afford an apartment, you can't afford to get married, you can't afford to become a full adult participant in society. The second thing to understand about the why and how of the breakdown in the Middle East is that no one in the run-up to the Arab uprisings was unaware of these challenges. And that's a very important thing, I think, to understand. It's how governments dealt with these challenges actually ended up, in many cases, exacerbating the problems rather than resolving them. And we had a lot of talk and many efforts in the 1990s and 2000s to promote reform of governance and reform of economies in the Middle East. But when many Arab governments sought to adjust that social contract, they ended up, instead of developing a more inclusive social contract, negotiating adjustments with political and economic elites, whether it was elites within their own country or external institutions like the World Bank and the IMF. They reduced government hiring without really liberating the private sector to create growth. They brought new business cronies into their ruling parties instead of opening up politics more broadly. And the result of these kinds of adjustments exacerbated inequality, further empowered some groups at the expense of others, and really increased the grievances rather than resolving them. And so dissent increased, government's tools to manage politics were weaker, and the protests broke out. And this brings me to the third thing we have to understand about how this all happened: the consequences of how certain states broke down. When the protests came, many governments responded poorly in ways that exacerbated divisions, collapsed state institutions, and some governments responded with violence in ways that generated demand for more violence. And so it's no accident in this analysis that Syria and Libya are the places in the region that are most violent and most disordered. These are the places where leaders ruled in the most personalized manner, where the destruction of civil society and community institutions, or the making of those things subservient to the state, was the most complete. And so having failed to act in a manner that could have prevented these uprisings, when the uprisings came, these leaders sought to repress their people through the use of force. And when basic governance and order broke down, those with guns to impose their will gained power. And when the state used violence against its citizens, it created a market for others with guns to defend those citizens against the state. And that allowed the emergence of identity-based sectarian militias, extremist groups with horrific agendas. So by the time these governments had broken down, the social contract had broken down over a long period before, and social trust, the basic trust between people and communities, had eroded. And there was very little left to manage peaceful politics. And this is the challenge we confront today in the Middle East. Beyond the geopolitical competition between Iran and Saudi Arabia, beyond the threat posed by extremist terrorism or weapons of mass destruction, this to me is the biggest challenge in rebuilding a stable order in the region is the breakdown of trust within societies. It's a consequence both of the way they were governed and the way they broke down. Now, the paper goes into detail on all these subjects and offers some specific priorities and approaches on a way forward to tackle that problem. Let me just give you a few highlights here. First, the future of the region will be determined not by the mere existence of governance, although that's what many are focused on in the midst of this disorder, but on the quality of that governance. Because if we don't have more accountable, responsive, transparent, and effective governance, it will not be sustainable governance. It will face more challenge. It will break down again. Conflicts that are suppressed will reemerge. So we have to think about the quality of governance, not just the fact of governance. And it's probably no surprise to any of you that I think liberal democracy is far more likely than any other regime type to generate accountable, transparent, responsive, and effective governance. But the path between where the region is today and liberal democracy is neither swift nor linear. And Ambassador Guia can testify to that, although I think Tunisia has made impressive progress along that path. The paper lays out a few practical ways to begin rebuilding the basis for that kind of sustainable governance. And let me just mention two key insights. First, I don't think the question we face regarding how to build this new order is about territory or state borders or where lines are drawn on a map. It's about what happens within those lines. Remember, it's about social trust. There's no line you can draw between Shia and Sunni in Iraq that will not be fought over. And just as the creation of South Sudan did not magically resolve the conflicts inside Sudan or South Sudan, division will not automatically resolve the conflicts within Iraq or Syria. It's also not about institution building. You know, after our military victories in Iraq and Afghanistan, the U.S. and our allies spent a lot of time standing up new institutions, parliaments, courts, political parties, central banks. And the idea is that you build this machine of government and you populate it and you start the gears turning and it should go. But I think we learned from these last 15 years that building institutions is not enough. It matters how those institutions are populated and by whom. Are they inclusive of everyone with a stake in the process? Do they have a process that people think is fair and transparent? And that brings me to the other insight that I want to leave you with before we have a broader conversation, which is that what's most important to effective, sustainable governance, to effective, sustainable institutions in the Middle East today is dialogue and conflict resolution. It seems like an obvious thing to say, you know, the old line that war is a continuation of politics by other means, but it is true. And I think it's a basic beginning aspiration for the future of the Middle East to shift conflicts that are now underway in a violent channel into a nonviolent channel. And also to pay special attention to those places where political conflict is being suppressed or dialogue is being suppressed for fear that those places may become violent if there's no room or no capacity or no institutions and forums for peaceful dialogue and peaceful politics. Finally, it suggests to me that sustainable governance in the Middle East in the future will be much more decentralized than it's been in the past. Because you don't rebuild social trust from the top down. You rebuild it from the bottom up. There's a broader need to build governance in a way that citizens can see and feel and buy into. And I think we already see a number of experiments across the region in more decentralized governance, whether it's the empowerment of elected councils in Morocco or the way in which Lebanese have managed their governance needs in the absence of a president until very recently, or the way the government in Baghdad is struggling to set conditions for locally effective government in the areas that are about to be liberated from ISIS. So I think local governance is what we need to focus on if we want to replace violence and mistrust with something more sustainable. And with that, let me stop and look forward to our conversation.
Let me just say a word. Thank you, Tammy, very much. It's a great paper, and I really do urge you to read it. Here's what we're going to do for the rest of the time. Amr is going to speak for about 10 minutes or so, reacting to the paper, giving you a little better sense of what's in it. And then we're going to have a conversation up here with some broad questions. Amr, over to you.
Sure. Thank you very much, Steve. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much, Tammy, for having me on the panel. And it's a pleasure to join the panel with Madam Secretary being with us today. It's a great paper. I would like to congratulate you, Tammy, and the working group on a spot-on analysis and great insights on how to look at Arab politics, Middle Eastern politics, and political dynamics as they appear today. I'm going to underline three points, which I feel are relevant in building on the insights and recommendations of the paper. Number one is, and here I truly share your analysis with regard to lost trust between state institutions and citizens in the region. And it's across a very wide spectrum, all the way from North Africa to the Gulf, all the way from republics to monarchies, all the way from countries which have been doing relatively better socioeconomically and countries which have been suffering from poverty, unemployment, grand corruption, and so on and so forth. So, yes, clearly we have been having a loss of popular trust in state institutions, and that has been happening and unfolding again in the background of Arab societies, Middle Eastern societies, lacking alternatives. It's not that they only lost trust in state institutions. They did not fashion alternative institutions. Credible alternative institutions were not put on the ground. We did see a bit of ideological contestation between religious-based visions and secular visions. We did see a bit of political contestation based on social and economic preferences, patronage, networks of patronage, which you really offer a very great analysis of, and a conflict between the haves and have-nots. But in total, this did not add up prior to 2011 to an alternative vision for state-society relations, an alternative, credible vision for a new social contract. So what we were looking at were old social contracts which were collapsing and new social contracts which were yet to be found, to be shaped, articulated, found, legitimated, and pushed forward. So the number one, and I believe this picture has not changed in the last 5 years. And the very fact that we are still looking at autocracies in return, reviving autocracies, or apart from the Tunisian case, or stable autocracies, or limited liberal experiments, as they have always been, be it in Morocco or elsewhere, the very fact that we are still looking at a region in spite of the dynamics of the last 5 years, where we do not have credible new social contracts, legitimate new social contracts, attests to that. So number one is how to bridge the gap between state institutions and citizens, groups, segments of Arab populations which have lost trust. The first key point I believe we really need to look at is the question of social capital. So I just would like to rephrase it away a bit from trust to look at how societies generate social capital. And social capital never comes top down. It always has to be bottom up. Now, when we look at the fabric of Middle Eastern societies, and I'm really focused on Arab societies, I'm not an expert on Iran. When we look at Arab societies as of now, the only way to imagine social capital emerging, leading to new social contracts, redefining the relationship between state institutions and populations, state institutions and societies, is to focus on civil society. If we are looking at state institutions away from the collapsed cases in Syria and Libya, where trust has been lost, legitimacy is questioned, pluralist deliberations are not out there, And if we do not have, apart from ideological contestation, political actors which offer visions for state-society relations, we do not have viable political parties in most Arab countries. We do not have viable political movements in most Arab countries. Once again, with the one exception of Tunisia, because it's unfolding in a different manner. It comes down to civil society, where, as well in Tunisia, civil society has been the leading force, one of the leading forces in pushing the country forward toward a true experiment of democratic governance. So the question is, how can we empower civil society organizations, civil society actors in the Arab world? What are the conditions available, present in different environments across the region, which can help civil society prosper? Or what are the conditions which are available in some countries which undermine civil society? And here I would like to highlight two key points. One is the very fact that we, in most Arab countries, we are still looking at constitutional and legal frameworks which, in fact, do not safeguard the autonomy of civil society actors, which undermine the autonomy and independence of civil society actors and subject them to a great deal of state control, typically security-led control. Secondly, because freedoms of association, organization, constituency building are not safeguarded in most Arab countries, civil society organizations as of now end up being urban-based, focused on small segments of the population, and do not have a comparable outreach to civil society organizations in any democracy, be it a Western democracy or a non-Western democracy. So two key issues which we have to look at if we are, and I share the analysis of, we will not get to real security if we do not fix governance issues, if we do not get to viable, stable, democratic governments or democratizing governments. So two key issues which we have to look at are how to put in place the real and right conditions for civil society organizations to prosper, for civil society organizations to represent people's interests, different segments of the population, and to articulate a new social contract, which is badly needed in most Arab countries. Secondly, how to safeguard freedoms, key freedoms, which no one, it's no longer fashionable to talk about freedom of association, freedom of organization in the Arab world, in spite of the fact that this is one of the regions which suffers most from violations of freedom of association and organization. Second point I would like to underline is, and once again going to a great insight which you offer, Tammy, in the paper, and of course the working group, on prioritizing justice. I really liked, it's one of the recommendations which Tammy articulates toward the end of the paper. Prioritizing justice, the way I understand the report referring to it, is to prioritize reforming security sectors, prioritize reforming judicial institutions, court systems, as well as the paradigm of law enforcement. And why? Because this is one of the key reasons why citizens lost trust in state institutions. Sometimes we politicize the debate about human rights violations and abuses away from citizens. It's not about the great political impacts of having regimes or governments which violate human rights and freedoms. No, it's about citizens and how they look at state institutions. It's about citizens and how they look at state security institutions, how they look at police stations, how they look at police officers, how they look at, in some places, as in Egypt, at the military security institution governing the country. Prioritizing justice means, in fact, to my mind, and here once again to build on the analysis in the paper, means to my mind, number one, and here not only internal actors can help, or civil society actors, but once again, non-governmental organizations operating outside of the Middle East can offer some help as well, because we do have expertise on how to do that. Number one is to look at Arab constitutions and laws in place governing judicial institutions, security sectors, military establishments, and try to push them to reflect two key values of what democracy is all about: accountability and transparency. If you follow Egyptian events, for example, throughout the last days, we have been hearing about citizens, at least two, who lost their lives in police custody. This is not a new phenomenon in Egypt. It keeps happening. It's what I'm referring to. The two cases are in the last 48 hours or 72 hours. And this, once again, is a testimony to, as long as we are going to lack accountability and transparency in security institutions, in relation to law enforcement, citizens will continue to have no trust in governments, even if they are elected, even if they are democratically legitimated. And here, international expertise can help how to push lawmaking, legal and constitutional frameworks in the direction of greater accountability and transparency. Secondly, and once again, here's Arab civil society actors need help, because in some countries they are facing not only the closure of public space, as in Egypt, but in a place like Bahrain and elsewhere, but they sometimes face a complete collapse, and they have to are evacuated of the respective country. Egypt civil society is not only a domestic set of actors, it's to a great extent a displaced set of actors which operate in Europe and elsewhere. So here, a degree of international cooperation, it doesn't have to be government to non-governmental, it can be non-governmental to non-governmental organizations, to help these actors facing displacements, facing a war of extinction, facing a war of evacuation, to endure. Final point, and once again, maybe it's not fashionable in the region, but I believe it is, and it will hopefully stay fashionable in the US, at least for some time. And here is the difference between civilian and non-civilian politics. And I guess one of the reasons when looking at questions of governance in the region, why it's important to differentiate and spend some time comparing Tunisia to Egypt, or comparing Algeria to Morocco, or comparing different countries where military establishments are dominant actors in politics, and other countries where we have civilian politicians and civilian political elites or civilian elites managing politics with all shortcomings of their political arenas, is the very fact that pushing forward compromise, pushing forward consensus building, pushing forward cross-ideological alliances, pushing forward new social contracts where citizens can hold their governments accountable, is not all of that is not easily done if you have military governments in place, or if you have governments dominated by military security establishments in place. So one key distinction when you look at Arab countries in 2016 is to differentiate between countries where the military security establishments are the dominant players in politics, and countries, once again, Tunisia, Morocco, and elsewhere, where civilian political dynamics and civilian groups are in charge. We have a track record of civilian groups accepting more inclusion, accepting more compromise, as opposed to military security establishments. So here too, this has to be a focus when we look at governance and how to push for democratic governance, as your paper suggests. Let me stop here.
Thank you.
Amr, thank you very much. I want to ask one technical question, because I was, I think, misled by it, and I want to make sure the audience isn't as well. You used the phrase privatizing justice. And of course, I had the notion of, you know, the private sector taking over the police. But I think what you mean is a transparency and accountability that allows citizens to hold those institutions to account.
Exactly.
Have I got it right?
Sure. Terrific. We can say citizen accountability and justice.
There you go.
Yes, there you go.
All right. We've talked about, and Tammy, I want to pick up on something Amr said at the end and you said at the beginning. You talked about how the failures of states to govern effectively led to the collapses or civil wars in Iraq, Syria, Libya, and Yemen. And so one question is, are other states in the region at risk? Have we seen the last of the dominoes, or are there other dominoes that potentially could fall? And if so, what will bring that about?
I think that's a crucial question, because for all that our international attention is focused on the eggs that have already fallen off the wall, there are others that are up there wobbling. And there have been a number of analytical attempts to sketch out what did those broken eggs have in common And you've seen some arguments about republics being more vulnerable than monarchies, for example. What I see in the places that I would say are today still vulnerable, it's those places where, as we saw in Egypt, you have an aging leader with no clear succession plan and certainly no transparent, accountable, responsive mechanism for determining succession. Those are potential crisis points for any government. And you know, we've just been undergoing our regular exercise in the peaceful transition of power here. It's, you know, it is always a delicate moment, even for the most established democracies. But in those places that don't have established traditions, it can be a very dangerous moment. So I would look, for example, at Algeria, where you have an aging leader who's been in place for a long time and no evident successor, no evident process, no evident consensus on a way forward. I think you could say the same about the Palestinian Authority today. And so you have a looming succession crisis and no connection, as Amar was highlighting, between citizens and government, where they don't feel like there's any channel to weigh in. That's a boiling pot.
Amar, would you agree with that? Yeah,
yes.
Anything you'd want to add?
Yes, yeah. Very much. I mean, it's Tammy is right in pointing out the historical precedents, which we did have in the region prior to 2011. Egypt was in a succession crisis where prior to 2011, the talk of the country was who is going to succeed former President Mubarak. I guess she is right in pointing out Algeria. But Steve, when you look at it, what is missing is not only ruling establishments putting forward a succession plan of sorts. What is missing as well is how to tackle the lost confidence in any arrangement between governments and citizens. In Tunisia, confidence is on the rise because Tunisia managed to put institutions in place. Different shortcomings are out there. Everyone's talking about them and analyzing them. But you still have a constitution, institutional framework in place, which makes sense. What is missing in Egypt, once the autocracy was back in, is that these constitutional institutional arrangements which people attempted after 2011 were thrown away, and we are in between reviving what existed prior to 2011 and maybe going back to very dark moments in Egyptian history. And the same goes for a place like Algeria. Once Bouteflika is no longer there, no one knows what will happen.
Yeah. Now, this leads to another place, and I'm going to ask Madeline to start on this one. It's interesting because the places you picked were Algeria and the Palestinian Authority. Those are not traditional monarchical societies. And one of the things you may remember when we started this project, we said this is about a crisis of legitimacy in the Middle East. And we said, of course, legitimacy comes from the consent of the governed and the ability to leave services. And a number of people said, wait, that isn't a sophisticated enough. There are other forms of legitimacy in the region based on tribal associations, religious affiliations, revolutionary ideology. There are a range of forms of legitimacy. So how do you square that? You know, what as we look at the Middle East going forward past 2011, what do we say about legitimacy, and what do we say to these regimes that may be teetering on the shelf but have not fallen off? What in this post-2011 world, what is the way, what would we recommend to leaders as to how to enhance the legitimacy of their regimes before they go through what these other countries are going through?
I think Tammy mentioned social contract a lot, and I think we have to remember what it is. I think people think of it as a Western concept, but that basically people gave up some of their individual rights to a state in order to get protection and security in some form. And obviously that is different with a monarchy. But still there is that same responsibility of what is it that the leader owes his people. And I think when you were asking about different countries, I think those are interesting ones that were picked. But I would say that this is almost like a virus. And one of the things that we have not talked about enough is the influence of technology. And one of the things that really did bring up, it starts with a man in Tunisia who immolates himself, and the news gets out, and all of a sudden it spreads. And I think that clearly what happened in Tahrir Square was social media. And so I actually think no place is inured to it. And so one of the questions, and I kind of hate to finger any country, but if you look at a country like Jordan, for instance, that is a monarchy, frontline state, in one of the most difficult refugee situations, not a rich place, and a king who is trying to figure out the various coalitions, and kind of a transit point, and it goes to the very point as to whether the state is providing a livelihood to the people. And I think that one of the things, and really you're right about this a lot, Tammy, in terms of what is it that the state owes the people? And initially, in all these countries, they were the employer of first resort. And when that is not possible anymore, then that puts in question the trust issue. And so legitimacy, to a great extent, I think, in this day and age, depends on whether the old leader, the new leader, the king, the deputy crown prince, or whatever, actually is delivering, because technology has made it possible for people to know what people in other places have. And especially, just to bring another point into what you said about the younger generation, they are technologically adept. And by the way, I have been talking about, this has been a peculiar 10 days, but basically, in addition to the thing you think I'm talking about, is that I've just spent time with a group of former foreign ministers in Silicon Valley talking about technology and governance, and what it has done in terms of providing people information as to whether they have a legitimate government. Mm-hmm. And it has disaggregated voices in a way that makes some of the organizational things you're talking about hard. Now, some of you have heard me say this, and I always admit that I stole this line, but the thing that is interesting is people are talking to their governments on 21st century technology. The government listens to them on 20th century technology, or hears them but may not be listening, actually, and provides 19th century responses. And so that disconnect is what we're dealing with, and it was very evident in Egypt. And the question is, I think any place could be subject to this, despite the fact that the ones you chose are very specifically so. But legitimacy is, what is the government supposed to be doing, whether it's a king or a dictator?
Got that. I just want to push it one more to you, Tammy, and that is this. Clearly, what is the government supposed to be doing? What is it delivering for its citizens? And you talk a lot about transparent, effective, accountable, and inclusive states. Does encouraging states to move in those directions, in fact, is it complementary to or supplementary to other traditional forms of legitimacy that, for example, the monarchical states are dependent upon? Or does it, in fact, risk undermining those other sources of legitimacy? Because it seems to me you have to be able to answer that question if you go to a monarch and say, you need to move in the direction of legitimate, transparent, responsive governance. That monarch has to have some understanding that that can be supplemental to and doesn't undermine the traditional sources of legitimacy on which the regime is dependent.
Sure. So I actually think that there's an important switch in language that I would recommend in order to answer this question, which is, it's not about what governments owe citizens. I think that it's really about what citizens expect from their government. Not what they need, but what they expect. And that's part of what's changed. And that's part of the impact of technology that Madeline was describing. Mm-hmm. And one of our other working group co-chairs, Chris Schroeder, really put his finger on this in his paper, which is that part of what's happened in the Arab world and around the world among this younger generation is what he calls a participation revolution, that citizens, because of technology, but just because this generation of Arabs more highly educated, healthier, more engaged than any generation before. I mean, let's remember that parts of the region two and three generations ago didn't even have secondary schools, okay? So the developmental leaps here are tremendous. And this rising generation has a different set, a globalized set of expectations. That means it's not just about making sure they have a job. They expect to be able to participate. They expect to be able to set their own path in life and not just have it directed for them by their monarch or their father or their uncle or anybody else. And at essence, what they expect is the thing that liberal societies are best structured to provide, which is the opportunity for every individual to find their own path to human flourishing, okay, if I can put it in philosophical terms. So it's not, governments can't get away with just, you know, offering enough jobs or enough healthcare or enough free education. Check the box and they are legitimate. They have to meet that set of expectations. They have to give people opportunity to find for themselves a pathway. And that means they have to be more open. They have to be more responsive. Now, to the point of congruence or tension, it is a mental shift. If you are a very traditional leader who believes that the only way you can help your society grow is by directing it from the top down. But that is not the only form of legitimacy, even for a monarch. So the traditional pathway may be, I am the source of social goods. I distribute them. But you can also be the source of opportunities. You can be the source of dynamism. And that is a shift in mentality, but it's entirely possible.
But I think one other thing, though, that has to be put into the mixture, and again, Egypt is a perfect example, is to what extent is it the freedom of disaggregated voices in Tahrir Square or order? At a certain point, I've been saying, for instance, that the young people in Tahrir Square were all having an incredibly interesting time, having been gotten there by social media. And the older man who cannot get to his stall in the marketplace says, I can't stand this anymore. I need some order. And so I think one could actually be persuaded that Sisi was elected, or that there was really a movement to have that happen, because people were fed up with the chaos. And I think the hard part is how inclusivity and getting participation, whether people are tolerant enough to go through the chaos time until they get to the proper time.
Yeah.
It's very good. And I want to go to Amar on that. I want to rephrase it a bit, and that'll be our last question, and then we'll go to the audience. If you remember, Lawrence of Arabia, at one point, one of the figures says, I'm a river to my people. And that's a sort of an old traditional form of legitimacy. What you're really saying is a legitimacy based on satisfying what the people expect from their government, and increasingly that includes participation and a role in fashioning their own future. I get that. So let's go to Sisi. I've spent three-hour sessions with him in the last 12, 14 months, and I have tried to make this argument that this is a source of legitimacy. This is what he must do if over the long term he's going to be able to bring stability and prosperity. And I have not yet made the sale. And what you hear is what you would expect someone, given the trauma that Egypt has been through. It is, I understand what you're saying, but you need to understand this is a difficult time. There is extremism at the door. And we cannot, the Middle East cannot stand a breakdown in order of a country of 90 million people. Because if you think the refugee flows are bad now to Syria, you just wait if Egypt breaks down. So what is the argument you make to Sisi, who sees himself as defending his country and the region against extremism, that is his vocation, one in which I think he sincerely believes and in which he's risking his life? How do you make the argument to him that actually this is where he's got to go if he's going to bring long-term stability to his country?
Well, I mean, this is basically the debate we're having in the region since not only 2011, but even earlier on. And we do have enough historical precedents and enough cases across the region to push forward a very clear plea, not only argument, for autocracies cannot provide for long-term stabilities. They never managed to do so. Now, Egypt was governed autocratically before 2011. And what happened after 2011, starting, in fact, to be accurate, it did not begin simply on January 25th, 2011. We had years of protest activism, young people primarily protesting and demanding that their voices should be heard, their concerns should be addressed. And again, in the background of a failing government which cannot address these concerns, people took to the streets. And I beg to differ because these were not only young people. Maybe in the beginning there were young people, but increasingly people with grievances, which you do a great job in the paper highlighting and outlining socioeconomic grievances and their impacts. In a country where you have a 30% rate of poverty, unemployment among young people over 40%, among female young female citizens over 45% and more, grievances did bring people to take to the streets and go to Tahrir Square and elsewhere. So the argument is autocracies never managed to provide for long-term stability. Right. I take it very seriously that there are risks, security challenges, not only terrorism, but different security challenges in the region that need to be accounted for. Now, the question is how to get governments, and the only way to get them is by listening to civil society actors. So we need an organized representation of citizens support to get governments to listen to how to do it right. I believe Egyptian civil society actors offer some solutions. You do not have to undermine more trust among citizens by harassing, violating key human rights, by imprisoning and by killing citizens in police custody and elsewhere, and not providing enough even social and economic solutions to improve their living conditions. If they listen, if rulers, governments listen to their own constituents, not only their military and security establishments, not only their business elites which benefit and thrive on the patronage systems that do exist, if they listen to civil society actors, they will find solutions. Finally, the irony of the Arab modern state is, in fact, it was the Arab modern state which pushed forward the developmental leaps you were referring to. It's a creation of the 1950s and 1960s. This was created by the modern state. And in a way, the modern state enabled developmental work to happen, enabled leaps in education, in healthcare, and elsewhere. And yes, it is the healthiest and most connected generation of young Arabs we are looking at. But in a way, these governments have become anachronistic. They no longer address their concerns, and they've got to listen to what these voices are demanding in different manners.
I think that it's a false choice between mass mobilization a la Tahrir Square and authoritarian order. And I would say it's not that a leader is a river for his people, but the people are a river. And like water, they're going to find an outlet. So the challenge is whether you can create channels and mechanisms and pathways mm-hmm. for people to have the influence they want to have over their own lives and the lives of their communities, or whether, left with no alternative, they will spill into the streets. And the failure of reforms in the period leading up to the uprisings is what compelled that mass mobilization. So what we see in Egypt today that troubles me very much, and that I think itself is quite destabilizing and dangerous, is a leader who believes that he, by putting a lid on it, mm-hmm. has lowered the boil in the pot. And as you all know, when you put a lid on a pot, the boil increases. And that's what I think we've got in Egypt right now. We have no civil society channels. We have no mm-hmm. effective political channels because the parliament yeah. and the party system are so tightly managed. We have no free speech channels. And so that pot is boiling very fast in a way that I think is far more dangerous in many ways than the situation that Egypt was in before the uprising.
I love your phrase, the leader isn't the river to his people. The people are a river, which if the leader does not channel, will spill over into the streets. Mm-hmm. And that's not a bad way to summarize this.
Try it on CC, see how he likes it. Yeah.
I'll wait till Madeline's with me.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Brookings for providing audio. Please spread the word and promote the Lawfare podcast via your social networks on Twitter, Facebook, and email. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Happy Thanksgiving, and thanks for listening.